Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Elizabeth Warren makes a campaign stop in Utah. Neighbors of the planned inland port say they fear it will mean an end to their rural way of life. The state of Utah won't enforce its 18-week abortion ban for now. And Utah reaction to the release of the Mueller report, redactions notwithstanding. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jen. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Reporter Bethany Rogers. Hi, Bethany, and welcome to you.
Hi, thanks.
And we also have reporter Taylor Stevens in studio. Welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
Listeners, we invite you to join this conversation. You can call 801-355-8255 or tweet us at KCBW. And you can also post your questions at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. All right. Well, in case you somehow were not aware, the Mueller report was released yesterday. U.S. Attorney General William Barr made the report public, though it was highly redacted due to ongoing legal cases and for security and other reasons. And around the country, the release of the document and the information it contained meant different things to different people. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, the Tribune had a roundup of reactions from Utah politicos. How was Utah's political class reacting, Jen? And you know, what were members of our delegation in Washington, for example, saying about the release of the Mueller report?
I think in a lot of ways, it was a political Rorschach test. Like, you saw what you wanted to see. And you saw that reflected in the social media statements from our representatives. You saw that from others in the media. It confirmed certain things if you believed one way, and it raised even more questions if you believed another way. I would say that on the whole, our Republican delegation answered in lockstep with their party. Partisanship. Senator Lee sent out a tweet that there was no collusion. It's definitive. Representative Stewart said there was no conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia. Interesting, because there are still a lot of questions when it comes to the Russia part. Representative Bishop, no obstruction of justice. And again, there are questions raised by the Mueller report that make that not quite as clear cut. Interestingly, Senator Romney withheld judgment. And he said, I haven't read the report. I'm not going to comment quite yet. And I think that kind of restraint is atypical in politics. And then we saw the lone Democrat, Representative McAdams, really kind of honing in on the Russian meddling question. All of them express sentiments like, let's move on already. And I think that, you know, that does, there's a segment of the population who is fatigued by this 22-month investigation. You know, we just want to get beyond it. On the other hand, I mean, it does raise so many questions about the circle of friends that the president had around him, advising him, raises a lot of questions about his own behavior. Just some interesting tidbits. Now, I have to confess, I have not read all 448 pages yet. It will be some interesting weekend reading.
Yeah, I'm sure a little light reading for you on the side. You know, on the statement that there was no obstruction of justice, the report specifically declines to clear the president on that. On that matter, although I think that, you know, the jump between what evidence there is for obstruction and then basically whether or not you can prosecute on that are two different sort of things to weigh there. Mm-hmm. And then on McAdams' point about finding justice in Russian meddling, Russia did interfere in the election to help work to get Trump elected, though it did so apparently without coordinating with the Trump campaign, according to what we know so far from the release of this document. A lot has happened. You talked about the fatigue. I'm reminded of a quote from a novel, "History is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake."
Yes.
And I don't know. Are we going to be able to move on, Jen? Is there a big national catharsis in the offing, or are we? You know, how much more of this do we have to endure?
Oh gosh, it's never over. You know, I saw a lot of commentators yesterday saying this is just the beginning. You know, this is another phase in a very complicated question about not only the legal definitions of our expectations for our leadership, but the moral implications, the ethics around what the presidency should represent. I suppose that if we had a Democrat, this is my conjecture, if we had a Democratic majority in the Senate, we would be looking at impeachment right now. I mean, I think there are enough questions. Impeachment is a political process trying to validate certain things. It's not a legal process, but it is a political one. And I think that you would already find plenty of evidence to bring this president to an accounting. I don't know if that would result in removal, but I do think that, you know, when you have, how many is it, 30 some odd people in his inner circle, including his personal attorney and the national security advisor, who have been, who have pled guilty to certain infractions, you have to know that the taint just doesn't wash off of the person at the center of this drama. So I tend to think that, sorry, we're going to keep dragging you through this, but it's important for our nation's identity and our political future just to get those questions answered.
34 is the number 34. Of people who, as a result of the investigation, entered guilty pleas or were charged. We learned about hush money payments as a result of this investigation from, you know, resulting from alleged affairs. And yeah, there's a lot. It's interesting. I feel like we've hit sort of already full Mueller report saturation.
Yes.
In the first 24 hours of news cycle. But let's actually, Jen, let's move on to some other news from this week, since this is being talked about a lot elsewhere. And let's bring Taylor Stevens into the conversation. And Taylor, I want to talk to you about Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was in Utah this week, on Wednesday, actually, for a political event. This was before the release of the Mueller report. Before we get into what she said while she was here, Warren actually made some news about Utah before she even arrived, right, with an essay that she published. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so she published an essay on Medium.com ahead of her visits to Salt Lake City, and I believe on Monday she was in Denver, and basically outlined a bunch of policy positions. She is sort of positioning herself as the policy wonk in the Democratic field, which, as we know, is quite large, I think 18 candidates now. And among some of the policy positions she outlined was a moratorium on new oil and gas mining and drilling on her first day in office. She also had some Utah-specific policy that she outlined, including the restoration of Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument back to the size that was established under President Barack Obama, and as we know, was reduced under President Trump. And so she had a bunch of policies. A lot of them, even if they were not specific to Utah, would affect Utah because so much of our land is federally owned here.
Sure, questions of public lands in the West. Taking that stance that she's taking is going to, you know, win her some votes in Utah, but will also lose her votes in the state of Utah. And that actually brings us to the question of you know, why? Why did Warren even decide to come to Utah, Taylor? And do Democratic candidates for president normally come to Utah at this early of a stage in the presidential election cycle?
So Warren is actually the third candidate to visit Utah in this cycle, obviously the most well-known of the presidential candidates to visit the Democratic presidential candidates. But I think now that Utah has Super Tuesday, that we're going to see that change the game a little bit. And I expect that we will see at least a few more, if not many more, visits from Democratic candidates. You know, every delegate counts, and they want to make sure that they are kind of appealing to the entire nation rather than a few states.
Before we go into her visit, Jennifer Napier Pierce, Utah being a part of the Super Tuesday primary, this is a new thing in Utah. We are now part of this one day, the earliest primary in the nation for those primary elections. And so I don't know. I guess this will bring greater attention to Utah, and that's probably the point of this law in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we haven't quite figured out how to navigate that, because we've flown under the radar for so long. We've been a red state for decades. I do think that this newfound attention is somewhat of a novelty. My take on Warren is her early environmental stance really is to bolster support among environmental groups to get that money. I mean, they're big funding mechanisms that go through green groups. And I just think that she's trying to tap into that fervor. Her statements, I felt, were she needed to do a little more homework on them. I don't know that the president can unilaterally like ban all oil drilling and on all public lands. Maybe I'm wrong, but that felt a little naive. But I do think that she is sort of staking a claim on environmental issues and on climate change. But I will say, you know, like Taylor said, there is some renewed interest in coming to Utah. And it'll be really interesting to see how we as a people react to that attention, that national spotlight. Let's not forget, though, the Bernie Sanders came and he attracted huge crowds. So I think that the McAdams election, the Democrats may see a glimmer of hope where for decades, like no Democrats were ever going to get traction here. And again, in, at the 2015-2016 election, we did see Ted Cruz come and we saw Governor John Kasich come on the Republican side. So I don't know. Maybe we're part of the mix now.
And, but those changes were before that change, or those changes, those visits were that change to election law. Still massive turnout for those caucus things. So this is the result of a law that was spearheaded by Senator Kurt Bramble, who I guess is just trying to make us more relevant. I mean, is that the point of this, is to try and attract? I know that we were also talking about having debates in the state of Utah, presidential debates. I wonder if that plays into this. I don't know.
Well, here's a couple of factors. Bramble has been a past president of the National State Legislature. I can't remember what the acronym is. We have Thomas Wright, who is on the National Republican
Committee.
We have Enid Waldholtz, who also has a high profile place. We have Senator Mitt Romney's niece, who is actually the chair of the National Republican Party, the RNC. So it's like, you know, there are some Utah ties, and I do think that they want to elevate the profile of the state.
Okay. Taylor, let's turn back to the visit from Senator Warren. How was she received, and what did she have to say while she was here in Utah? Did she actually double down on that public lands environmental stance?
Yeah, so she actually did a visit to Big Cottonwood Canyon area earlier in the day, and that's where a bunch of reporters followed her around as she had kind of a tour of the area, asked some questions about ecology and land management of the Save Our Canyons Foundation, whom gave her a tour. And so that was kind of the area where she spent most of her time focusing on public lands. And her event at the depot later that night, which was very crowded, and a lot of people didn't get in, and she went out and spoke to those people. So she was a little late getting on stage, but she was very well received by the crowd that came out and stood in a huge line to see her. And she spent most of her speech, if you followed Elizabeth Warren on kind of the national scale, it was pretty much what you'd expect from her, kind of a populist message focusing on economic opportunity and the challenges facing America's middle class. And that's really the message that she was driving home kind of in her evening speech.
I was shocked at the fervor, like the enthusiasm bubbling over in your stories and in the photographs that we saw. I mean, there was a lot of support here for Elizabeth Warren, which I guess I shouldn't be surprised, right. But in such a crowded field of Democrats, I was surprised by the turnout.
Yeah, and talking to people afterward, you know, who were waiting in this massive line that seemed hardly to move as I talked to them to get a photo with Elizabeth Warren. She had pledged to take a photo with everyone there. One girl told me that Elizabeth Warren was her woman crush. Another man said that he would vote for a potted plant over Trump, but that there's something about Warren that he just loves. You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm for her. And like you said, you might expect people more to be feeling it out. But a lot of the people I talk to know Elizabeth Warren is their candidate.
That's what I was going to say. I was wondering if the majority were there to decide or if they had already made up their mind. But it sounds like you answered that question there. And maybe we expect more visits from presidential candidates as a result of this change to Utah election law. It is time now for our first break in the show. But Taylor Stevens, thanks very much for your reporting on this. Still to come, Utah's new law banning abortions after 18 weeks. is, sorry, excuse me, I got lost here for a second. That is not going to be enforced in the state of Utah for now. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens and editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them to the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or tweet us at KCPW. Last week on the show, we talked about the lawsuit filed by Planned Parenthood and the ACLU of Utah over Utah's 18-week abortion ban. Bethany Rogers, there is an update on that story, and the state of Utah is not going to enforce this new law, this ban on abortion after 18 weeks of gestation. Explain why that is the case, Bethany.
Essentially, they said it's because it's a very complicated issue that they think that this case deserves a lot of time and attention, and that they agree that they should look into it before just jumping into enforcement immediately. So they agreed, the state attorney general's office agreed, you know, the state will not enforce this. And then yesterday we had a federal court hearing where a judge basically asked all parties in the case if they were on the same page with that and then issued the injunction to stop the law from taking effect in May.
And that's, again, because of this lawsuit. Can you just remind us what this lawsuit is based on? ACLU of Utah and Planned Parenthood Association of Utah filed it to challenge this 18-week ban.
Yeah. So essentially, the lawsuit claims that the law is unconstitutional and it violates longstanding Supreme Court precedent, which has held that states can't make laws to ban abortions before the point of viability in a pregnancy. And that point in a pregnancy is the subject of some debate, but generally it's thought to be around 24 weeks. 18 weeks is far before anybody really thinks that a fetus would be viable. This issue was actually even tested in Utah itself at one point. And back in the 90s, the state passed a law that would have restricted abortions at 22 weeks, and the courts even overturned that. So the Planned Parenthood and ACLU are saying, even by Utah's standards, that this law is unconstitutional.
A little bit of deja vu in the legal realm. Is the fact that the Office of the Utah Attorney General is taking this action, does that in any way mean that they see a problem with the law that was passed at this year's legislature, that ban?
No, they didn't. They did not back down from defending the law in any way. They were just saying essentially they needed more time to review the issues that were in play. And I spoke with the sponsor of the bill after the court hearing yesterday, Representative Cheryl Acton. Mm-hmm. She said she's not named as a party in the lawsuit, but she's obviously, since it was her bill, continuing to follow the issue as it winds its way through the court. And she said essentially the idea was they didn't want to tip their hand by arguing over an injunction, that you know, they wanted to kind of hold onto their cards until the case is actually debated in court later on.
The cards being the legal arguments they will make.
Exactly.
You know, there's an interesting aspect of this story, which is that how the new law is supposed to be enforced, Bethany. It's supposed to prosecute doctors if they are found to have carried out an abortion after 18 weeks. The Salt Lake County attorney, Sim Gill, would have to enforce that under the law. Why is that the case, and what has his response been? I know he's had a kind of legal response to the lawsuit and also, well, I guess the lawsuit.
Yeah, it was interesting. As you said, he's named as a defendant on the lawsuit along with the state, but he filed a separate response from everybody else that sort of clarified his own position. Now, he's named specifically in the lawsuit because the only abortion providers in the state are within Salt Lake County. So if any prosecution were to happen, it would happen within his jurisdiction, which is why Planned Parenthood and ACLU wanted to prevent him from taking any enforcement action at this point. In his statement, he basically said that he also sees constitutional problems with the law, that he has concerns about enforcing something that's been settled at a federal level for so long, and that he and his prosecutors will not be taking action against any physicians until either the Supreme Court or the 10th Circuit Court basically upholds this law and forces them to.
Jennifer Napier Pierce, we're waiting for the courts, the legal challenge, for this particular bill, this law wasn't actually unexpected. The fact that it would be a challenge that was that would move through the courts also, I think, wasn't unexpected. Your thoughts here on just the fact that there is this pause on the enforcement of this law?
Well, it's
go ahead.
It's very prudent on the part of the AG's office. I think they are practical, and it is part of their strategy. As Bethany said, I mean, they're not backing down from defending this law. It's just, like you said, kind of a pause. And I guess that's what they have to do. I think it's an exercise in futility. 2 to 3 million dollars of taxpayer money to go toward this case. But Representative Acton feels like the political winds are behind her. And I understand the impulse. I just disagree with it. I think that this law is completely misguided.
Well, it's on the books now, and it's being challenged in the courts. Bethany, how have abortion rights activists or advocates out there, how have they responded to the fact that there is a pause in enforcement? I mean, was that pause actually, before we go there, was that pause a decision by the Attorney General's office, or was that sort of a court-mandated pause?
It's a little of both. So essentially, they went into yesterday's court hearing with all parties on the same page saying, yes, we're going to hold off, and then the judge basically enacted that as an official order from the bench. So it's sort of both and. If the AG's office had not agreed to it, then they probably would have argued it in court and the judge would have made a decision.
Okay. And then in terms of the response from the groups that have filed this lawsuit?
Oh, they're very pleased that, I mean, they say that they're glad that, abortion services will not be restricted in May and that, the current status quo will continue as this lawsuit is in court.
Okay. We don't know how long it will take to make its way through court. There's been some interesting analysis that points to a perhaps more effective way of lowering the number of abortions in Utah. And it's not exactly rocket science. It's about preventing unwanted pregnancies in the first place. And Bethany, some groups out there are pointing to an increase in access to birth control and a resulting drop in abortions in Utah that could come as a result of Utah's recent expanded access to Medicaid coverage in the state, and also from some recent changes to Utah law. Can you tell us about this, Bethany?
Yeah, there are a few different things going on there. One, as you said, Medicaid expansion will provide coverage for contraception to an estimated 11,000 women. This is something that the state has been, some groups in the state have been looking to do for some time. But essentially, lower-income women now that are covered by this would be able to get any form of contraception that they want under Medicaid. At the same time, there are groups out there that feel that there are gaps that still exist for people who are above 100% of the federal poverty line. And so there are some private efforts. There's a group with ties to the University of Utah that is looking to expand contraception care especially in rural areas of the state. And they're working with care providers in those areas to train doctors and physicians to provide services to people who might need subsidized care, and also to continue advocating at the state level to even expand Medicaid coverage for contraception and birth control further. And they're looking to hit up to 250% of the federal poverty line. So quite a significant jump even from where we are now.
And there's data from other states showing success of programs that, in terms of, I guess, savings to a state, in terms of states that have given greater access to family planning services to their residents. Can you talk about them?
Yeah, there are several different states that have significantly expanded either, Medicaid coverage. There was one state that expanded up to 300%, and those efforts have shown significant savings of millions of dollars in not having to provide medical care for unwanted pregnancies and health care services. And then also a potential reduction in things like teen pregnancies and abortion rates.
Utah lawmaker Representative Ray Ward, in your article, says that extending reproductive services, and this just kind of circles back to the story we were just talking about, to 8,000 Utahns. If you extend the services to 8,000 Utahns, you could prevent 2,000 unintended pregnancies and up to 680 abortions as a result of that, which is a different – maybe I'll bring Jennifer Napier-Pierce on this. This is obviously a different route than legislating a specific cutoff for abortions in the state of Utah. I'll let you expound on that if you don't mind.
Well, a couple of things. The Medicaid expansion. We also have birth control available without prescription. I mean, I think that Representative Ward has really become a champion of women's reproductive health, and it's an issue that's deserved attention in this state way too long. I mean, these are overdue measures, especially when you have the youngest population in the country, when we have very high birth rates. I do think that this is on women's minds, and it just has not been given the political heft that it's needed to get. So I applaud Representative Ward and the others who supported these measures, because it will help the quality of life for all women in Utah and all families in Utah.
We've talked a little bit about the fact that now in Utah you don't need a prescription essentially to go and get access to birth control. And in the past, I mean, you would have to go to your doctor,
yep,
have a conversation, and then seek a prescription before you could go and get birth control.
This is something men don't understand. Like, if you want some form of birth control, you had to go to the doctor like clockwork, or it would run out, and then what are you going to do, right? So I think this will just open up a lot of doors for women. There's a lot of freedom there to sort of navigate their own health. And it's not to say that I would discourage people from going to the doctor, but I mean, it's not always feasible at the time when you need stuff. So I think that having that ability to walk in, I think the pharmacists have to have a little bit of training or something, Bethany. But, you know, so it's not just being given out willy-nilly. But on the other hand, you know, women are responsible adults at this point, or not. I mean, if they're younger than that, they still can get the help that they need. Mm.
Bethany, in terms of the program you were talking about from the University of Utah and others who are working to increase access, you know, for those people who don't fall under the 100% of the poverty line or above, how and when are they going to start that program? Have they begun that program?
Yeah, they already have. They're rolling it out gradually. It's a 3-year effort, and they're expanding it clinic by clinic. So they already have a handful of places that they're working with, and that they hope, as funding continues to come in, to expand it to more.
Okay. Just before we head to one other quick break here in a minute, I want to ask about the status, if anybody knows in this room, of the other abortion bill in Utah. This is the abortion bill that was to prevent abortions in the cases where a mother makes a decision, a prospective mother makes a decision based solely on a Down syndrome diagnosis for the fetus. Has that seen a court challenge yet, Bethany? Do you know?
No, it hasn't. And there is a specific reason for that. The ban on abortions because of a prenatal Down syndrome diagnosis, there's a trigger clause so that portion of the bill will not go into effect until a higher court basically upholds a similar law in another state. So the portion that would potentially have legal problems is not even effective.
Okay. Jen, we wait for that as well to see what happens with other states.
That's right. And again, I understand the reasoning why people want Utah to be in line. But to me, this battle could be prevented because others are already in the battlefield, if that makes sense.
It does indeed. We are going to head to another break here in the show. And when we come back, we will have more from this past week's news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Bethany Rogers, and Taylor Stevens. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting us at KCPW. To some other news now, and Taylor Stevens, you covered a story about people who are living near to the planned Utah Inland Port. These are people in the Salt Lake City's northwest quadrant or surrounding areas, and they are worried about the character of their neighborhood changing as a result of the development of the Utah Inland Port. You profiled some of these people and their fears in a recent story. What kinds of impacts are they especially worried about, and who are we talking about?
Yeah, so just to back up a little bit and set the stage of kind of where this area is at. So you've got kind of this big chunk of the Inland Port, kind of I think what people traditionally think of as the Inland Port. And then kind of a little bit east of that, you've got this kind of tiny sort of rectangular shaped area that's sort of unusual. And that was kind of what I sort of got interested in, is what is planned for this piece of the port, kind of what's going on here. And so come to find out that this piece of the port was kind of designated as an aerospace alley, sort of a place where they can, it's near the Salt Lake International Airport, and a place where, you know, they can kind of meld aerospace into this distribution hub. And so that's just kind of the context. Hope that helps visualize a little bit
it
of
does.
Where this area is.
Thank you.
But these neighbors live really close to this slice of the port. You can walk into it from their front porches in 5 minutes. You can see it from, you know, their backyards. And they're kind of at the confluence of a lot of development and a lot of change. And that's not just from the port. That's from the expansion of the airport. Some of them lived there before the airport was kind of what it is today. It's also, you know, they live really close to Legacy Parkway, which is going to see some changes here soon when the truck ban is lifted. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of unfair, I think, to say all of the changes that they are worried about are directly related to the Inland Port, but that is a piece of the bigger picture. And this is kind of a wetlands area. There's a lot of wildlife. It's kind of one of Salt Lake's last rural areas. And, you know, it's 5 minutes from downtown, so you wouldn't kind of picture there to be what this is there. And they're worried about losing that way of life, and they really feel like it should be preserved. And so I think they're probably among the closest residents who will see kind of the first direct impacts of the Inland Port in Salt Lake City.
Do you, you know, you mentioned that aerospace alley designation for this little sliver or block of land that is on the eastern area of the Inland Port area, Inland Port Authority, as it was designated by the legislature. How does the defining that as aerospace alley happened. I mean, I do we really know what the plan for the port is on the whole when it comes to specifics of what will be developed where, and is that part of it?
We don't really know. A business plan is in the works, and that's been kind of the big question mark for about a year now, is kind of how is this area going to develop, not just this slice, but kind of the port at large. And so aerospace alley is kind of a nickname. Chris Conaby, the interim director of the Inland Port Authority Board, kind of colloquially known as this slice. But yeah, we don't really know what's going to happen. And I think that's part of the fear for residents, is that there's no business plan yet. There's no environmental study done, environmental impact study. And so they really don't know what to expect. They don't know if their property values are going to decline. They don't know if they should get out now or if they should try and hold on and fight for their neighborhood. And that's kind of the place that they're at right now.
You mentioned the changes in to other parts of this part of Salt Lake City, including the expiring ban on heavy trucks on Legacy Parkway. Someone in your article mentioned a big Ivory Homes development going in around there. Can you tell us about those concerns as well, especially about that development?
So it's an Ivory development, not necessarily an Ivory Homes development, which was confusing for me as well because this area is zoned as M1, which is light manufacturing. And I was wondering how they were going to get a housing development there. That's not necessarily the plan here, and I don't know what is. That's still kind of in the works to figure out. You know, so there's a lot of question marks for these neighbors. How is this development going to happen? How is the port going to develop? What's going to happen to Legacy Parkway? And I think being in that space where you don't know how your community is going to change can be scary for people.
Jennifer Napier Pierce, Tribune editor, has the newspaper sort of taken a stance on the way changes are happening or are planned in the Northwest Quadrant on the whole or on the inland port?
We've commented on process primarily when it comes to the inland port. I think that we will be opining further. But what I love about news generally and what the Tribune does specifically is, you know, part of what our strength is to provide snapshots, moments in time, and sort of chronicle the change. I think that we're going to see many more stories like this one as the explosive growth that has been predicted for a decade actually arrives. And how does that impact individual neighborhoods, individual families? How does the community at large sort of cope with that newfound identity? And I thought that Taylor's story really was a strong illustration of sort of the mixture of the fear of the unknown at this point, plus the human tendency to embrace the now. Mm-hmm. And you know, we like nostalgia. We like things. We move to certain places because we like the feel of it at that moment. Mm-hmm. But then the change comes and, you know, our sensibilities have to change, too. I think that we will see more stories like this as change is coming. And it's not going to be the inland port. It's going to be all sorts of, you know, industry coming in or massive influx of immigrants or whatever the change may be.
Right, or just people in general, population growth. Yep. Expecting to increase pretty substantially. The mayor, you mentioned for a moment there the sort of planning going on, the mayor and the process of planning going on, and the Tribune might weigh in on this. The Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski last week in a tweet criticized the state's engagement process for the inland port and then said that it's time for the state to say what they intend to do and then get feedback. So essentially tell us what you're going to do and then get feedback from the public. She also said that it was time for every elected official in Salt Lake City and for every candidate for office to clarify their support for her lawsuit, which is challenging the very existence of the port, challenging the way that it was created at the legislature. And that could launch us into the next story. Mm-hmm. on the launch of a mayoral campaign. But Taylor, can you just give us a quick refresher on the lawsuit that the mayor has filed over the creation of the inland port?
Yeah, and to be clear, this area in Salt Lake City, the master plan, which is kind of the plan for how, you know, an entity sees something developing, has always sort of envisioned this area as being some sort of port. What Biskupski is challenging is the state's creation of the port, so the usurpation of the land and the zoning authority and the tax differential. She sees that as kind of a land grab that is unconstitutional per the state law. So that's kind of what she is challenging. And I think that this will become a major campaign issue in this race because Biskupski has come out so strong on it and the council is on a very different page. So that's going to be kind of a challenge for whoever is in this seat next. How do you navigate the many fraught relationships in this landscape? How do you work well with the Inland Port Authority Board while also preserving the city's interests, while also, you know, appeasing the city council. That's a complicated issue.
Who wants that job again?
Yeah. Like 10 people.
A lot of people.
Like 10 people do.
Is that how many candidates are running for Salt Lake City?
We have 10 candidates
now.
Wow,
that is quite the
field. And the filing deadline is in July, I believe.
Yeesh, there's time.
Well, on that front, actually, I'd like to squeeze in a story about the race because Taylor, as you said, a number of candidates are running to replace Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, who announced not that long ago that she is not running for re-election for a second term. You attended the official kickoff of one of those candidates this week, Salt Lake City Council Member Erin Mendenhall. How did she launch her campaign and where did she do it?
Yeah, Erin Mendenhall is the most recent to officially launch, and she launched her campaign outside of an air quality monitor in Rose Park neighborhood. And she has kind of a long history of, she kind of entered politics in the air quality world. She was the co-chair of the Utah Clean Air Association. I'm getting the name wrong. But one of the air quality organizations she actually had co-chaired and co-founded.
Breathe Utah, I believe.
Breathe Utah, thank you. There's a lot of them.
There are.
But so she kind of got her entrance into politics in the air quality realm. And so she kind of wants to make that connection more implicit for voters, as well as she is making some kind of air quality policy stances central to her campaign. Among them, Salt Lake City currently has a plan to be have the government run kind of carbon neutral by, I believe it's 2032. She'd like to see that done by 2030. There is another candidate who has an even more aggressive plan than that. But air quality, I think, will also be a big issue in this campaign coming up.
So, I mean, trying to distinguish yourself on, well, it's funny. Every candidate is going to have to try and distinguish themselves one way or another. And she probably points to her council experience as well.
Yeah, she's one of two candidates with council experience.
Just circling back to the and Stan Penfold being the other one, correct?
Right.
Okay. To the story we were talking about before because the mayor issued this call for candidates and for elected officials to support her lawsuit or not, has anyone, Erin Mendenhall or any of the other candidates, heeded that call, come out and said this lawsuit is right for the city and should I be elected and it hasn't been resolved by then, I will continue to carry it forward?
So we had a story a few weeks ago after Biskupski left the race and where we asked everyone for their stance on the Inland Port. The field has grown since then, and I think that people are still kind of figuring out where they are on that. Nobody came out incredibly strong. I think Jim DeBacchus, former senator from Salt Lake City, said that he believes that the lawsuit should move forward. Others said that they think that they would try to come in and negotiate first, and then if they couldn't get anything done, they would move forward with the lawsuit. But that's definitely something that we at the Tribune are going to try and pin candidates down on once the field is set.
Right. I mean, knowing whether or not a candidate plans to keep pressing on the question of was this thing created constitutionally, I guess we'll find that out, and I'm glad that the Tribune will be doing that. Jen, instead of having you weigh in on the field of candidates and who's launched and what they're saying, maybe I'll ask for your comments on the mayor's move to sue over the Inland Port, and then what does the future hold for this suit, especially if it isn't resolved by the time that the next mayor, whoever that may be, takes office?
I can't imagine it would be resolved by then. I don't know. Litigation seems to take the long and slow path. So this will be a huge issue for the next mayor. If it is resolved, I don't think that the questions will still be completely settled. So, I think it's an interesting political move for Mayor Biskupski to call out others in the crowded field. Obviously, this is an issue that's very important to her, and she would like to get some allies on the next generation, whoever that leader may be. I do wonder, though, whether or not that is the litmus test for the public. Like, is that the issue, the single most issue that people care about? I would tend to think that it's going to be potholes and roads, I mean, I don't know. Do people in the city do they look at that high level issue, or are they more likely to vote on air quality or kind of the nuts and bolts of what city government does? I don't know.
Hasn't Salt Lake City, I mean, this is, you know, in time, as you see mayoral elections happening, hasn't the candidate who wins generally been sort of the most liberal of candidates? Salt Lake City is a, you know, an island inside of Utah that is not representative of the rest of the state, and oftentimes people are running to the left of each other. Are we going to see a race that runs that direction? I don't know if you want to weigh in on that, Jen.
I don't know. I mean, for me, I think choice is good. You know, I love to see this wide field of candidates bringing all sorts of issues to the fore, and some issues that may not have gotten a lot of traction in the past. So I think the diversity of voices is terrific for voters, and it's great for journalism because there's no end of stories that we can do. It'll be a fun election to cover, Taylor.
And obviously, this is a nonpartisan race, but we do know that most of the candidates are left of center. I think there are a few that are more conservative than others, and we'll try to appeal to that more conservative base that's in Salt Lake City. But it'll be interesting to see who, you know, there are two candidates will get through the primary to the general election. It will be interesting to see how different or alike those candidates are in their views.
Mm-hmm. So the field will be whittled down from 10 to 2 by November of this year. I mean, well,
August is the primary. And, you know, maybe it'll be 12 to 2 or 15 to 2.
Right.
We're not sure yet. So we'll see if anyone else enters.
Anyone else want in?
Yeah. Let me know. Yeah. Give me a call.
Officially announcing our campaigns, all of us here in studio right now. You know what? We have reached that time in the hour where we probably ought to turn to our final segment of the show. This is the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight a story that maybe didn't get a lot of play and could use some, or that we just weren't able to cover on the show today. And maybe I will start with Bethany Rogers and her pick for underplayed story of the week. Bethany, what have you got?
Okay, so my pick, I just thought this was a really fascinating story. It was about how the Utah State Bar is investigating a complaint about seven lawyers being polygamists. And it was a really interesting development because some people say that it could actually give polygamists something they need to challenge the state's bigamy statute by showing that it harms them directly. So
that's really interesting. I'm wondering, I know that this isn't your story, but I'm wondering if the reason the bar is looking into it is because it is, you know, these lawyers are, I don't know, they're members of the bar. They've passed the bar in Utah. They are breaking the law, though, by being in polygamist relationships. Is that, I guess, the ascent?
That's the sense that I got from the story, was that, yes, that would be the gist of the violation.
Nate Carlisle's reporting on that is worth a read. Check it out at sltrip.com. Taylor Stevens, we'll go to you for a pick for underplayed story of the week.
So we've spent some time talking today about 2019. We spent some time today talking about the 2019 election, but 2020 is also in our reporting this week from a story from Bethany. A group of Utahns is trying to persuade the state's voters in 2020 to pass a carbon tax. They are looking to diminish reliance on fossil fuels and generate money for local air quality initiatives. So the ballot initiative craze may not be over. We may be seeing more coming soon.
I have a little note on this. So I'd never heard of the man that was quoted in the story, Bethany. Mm-hmm. He's got an interesting name. Is it Yoram
Bowman? Yes.
So I was like, who is this guy? So I Googled him. He's an economist who is a comedian.
Stand-up
economist. I just thought, man, this is so great. This was really fun. But it's an interesting issue. I think that we'll follow. It'll be interesting to see if he can get traction.
Well, I mean, even if it gets traction at the ballot box or as the ballot initiative, what happens at the next meeting of the state legislature?
That's right.
Yeah,
2021.
That's right.
Here comes more news. All right. Thanks for your pick, Taylor, for Underplayed Story of the Week. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week as well.
Okay. I have spring fever. Have you been outside? It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And this week we had a story on the summer concert series coming up at Red Butte. So there are 31 acts that are coming. They're all magnificent. If you haven't been to Red Butte Gardens, it's a fun venue to go check out. My only complaint about it is there's a lot of chatter. People tend to see people that they know, and they don't really give all full attention to the performers. But there's like Lyle Lovett and Seal and Mark Knopfler and lots of others, and it's going to be a great lineup. So that's my pick of the week. I'm thinking forward to good weather.
All right. Jen's pick is for Underplayed Story of the Week is nice weather, go outside and hit the Red Butte concert series. And also weighing in on the should you go to a concert and pay attention to the musicians or not controversy.
Just a pet peeve, I'm just saying.
Okay, well, for my part, I'm going to go with the fact that there's a new bus. This is a cheap bus to Las Vegas, a new bus service that offers $5 introductory tickets from Salt Lake City to Las Vegas. This is a group called Flixbus, a European company that launched in the United States about a year ago. Lee Davidson has a report on this. I don't know when they're going to kick off, but you can get cheap tickets to Las Vegas. Hey, we have about a minute left. Anybody have an extra pick for Underplayed Story of the Week?
Well, I just want an addendum on the Vegas bus. So I was really trying to get a reporter to go on the maiden voyage of this bus and document who pays $5 to go to Vegas and how much are they willing to lose. Because, like, you know, if it only takes $5, then you've got some extra spending money to pour into the slots.
Jen, I volunteer as tribute.
Okay, we've got a taker.
I volunteer as well. That's great. All right, well, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Taylor Stevens, and Bethany Rogers, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today on Behind the Headlines.
Of course, thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Many thanks to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, here at KCPW and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, as well as our news intern, Sarah Sadie Khan. Thanks to you, Sarah. You can find podcasts of this and all of KCPW's local programs at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. And you can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook or on Twitter. Just search us there. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for joining us this week. And hope to see you again next Friday.